Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to the second Edward Said Annual London Lecture. We are particularly honoured that this lecture has again been given at the British Museum, and it's been given this evening by Professor Khalidi, because the British Museum, as you know, was set up to enable precisely this kind of conversation, created in 1753 by Parliament to allow the citizen to ask the difficult, the unwelcome, and the potentially troublesome questions about politics, history, religion, and society. The collection constructed to be a resource with the library for those inquiries and the place to be a forum in which those kind of conversations could occur. Over recent years, we presented a number of exhibitions to address this kind of issue on the long culture and history of Iran and at the moment on Afghanistan, looking at the troublesome, difficult, contested connection between a history, a religion, a politics, and contemporary events. And nobody, of course, has done more to shape the way we can all think about these issues than Edward Said, who redefined the kind of question and who gave us different tools to come to some kind of answers. And that's why we're particularly pleased this evening that the lecture is happening here. This year's lecture is supported by Maria Anselmo Cortas and by the A.M. Catan Foundation. And it's been given, as you know, by Professor Khalidi. I'm going to ask now Mariam Said to come to introduce this year's Edward Said lecturer, and would ask you to welcome Mariam Said.
Thank you, Neil. I would like to thank the British Museum, the sponsors, the A.M. Catan Foundation, the London Review of Books, Maria and Samer Cortas, and the lecture committee for making this evening possible. Jerusalem, as described in the Bible, conjures all sorts of mythical images, although the Holy Land of the Bible has very little to do with the reality on the ground. Jerusalem, like so many other great cities of the world, has seen many conquerors, and its inhabitants reflect that history. The Khalidis are one of the many prominent Palestinian families that have inhabited the city since the Arab conquest in 637. To any Arab, Rashid is a Jerusalemite, Qudsi, meaning from Jerusalem, simply because his family comes from there. However, Rashid was born after the Nakba, the catastrophe, in New York City, where his father was attached to the United Nations. He was educated mostly in the US and received his doctorate from Oxford University. Rashid's first job was at the Lebanese University in Beirut. He arrived there in 1974, and less than a year later, the Lebanese Civil War began. Rashid lived in Beirut during the first 7 years of the civil war, witnessing the Israeli invasion of 1982. His book, Under Siege, PLO Decision-Making During the 1982 War, was the result of this experience. After 1982, Rashid came to the United States, where he held teaching positions at several distinguished universities, and since 2003 has been the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University, and is also the director of the newly established Center for Palestine Studies at Columbia. As a historian of the Middle East, he has published several books that deal with various aspects of Middle Eastern history, from nationalism to Palestinian identity and the struggle for statehood to colonial policies and dominance in the area. In addition, he has written many essays on similar subjects, including a number that focus exclusively on Jerusalem. As you know, Jerusalem was divided in 1948 at the end of the war that the Israelis called their War of Independence and the Palestinians al-Nakba, or the Catastrophe. East Jerusalem was held by the Jordanian army, while the western part of the city was conquered by the Haganah. In 1967, Israel occupied the eastern part of the city and soon after annexed it. Although the international community has refused to recognize this Israeli claim to sovereignty over the whole city, thus began the process of what Israel calls the Judaization of East Jerusalem, by which Jewish settlers are encouraged to move in the eastern half of the city, while Palestinian Jerusalemites are forced out. This policy has been in continuous operation for the past 44 years. The past year has seen a rapid acceleration of this process. Ahmad Samih Al-Khalidi, Rashid's grandfather, was the director of the Arab College of Jerusalem, the highest institute of education for Palestinian men. This college was closed after the war of 1948. Who compiled a library of old manuscripts. Rashid spent a lot of time in the 1990s working on preserving this national treasure. As a result of this endeavor, he has written many essays on Jerusalem, such as The Intellectual Life in Ottoman Jerusalem, A Research Agenda for Writing the History of Jerusalem, The Future of Arab Jerusalem, for a Shared Jerusalem and Transforming the Face of the Holy City, Political Messages in the Built Topography of Jerusalem. And last but not least is The Centrality of Jerusalem to an End of Conflict Agreement. The gist of the last essay is, and I quote, "More than any other issue of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, Jerusalem has deep resonance for all the parties. Certainly, there will be no end to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, no Arab-Israeli reconciliation, and no normalization of the situation of Israel in the region without a lasting solution for Jerusalem. For a solution to be seen by all parties as satisfying, it must accomplish three things. It must show Palestinians and Israelis to share the city equitably. It must allow Jerusalem to be the capital of both Palestine and Israel, and it must allow people of all faiths to have free and unimpeded access to Jerusalem." Tonight, Rashid Khalidi will be lecturing on the ongoing building of a center for human dignity by the LA-based Simon Wiesenthal Center over part of the oldest Muslim cemetery in Jerusalem. In addition to being a controversial project that has raised questions of mutual tolerance in the city, it resonates for him personally, since the cemetery in question is where many of Rashid's ancestors are in fact buried. Please join me in welcoming Rashid Khalidi. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Neil McGregor, for that introduction. Thank you very much, Mariam, for your generous introduction. I'm reminded of different timescales by Neil's mention of the British Museum being founded in 1753. In Jerusalem, that would be a recent foundation. Very, very, very recent foundation. So we're talking about multiple different timescales when we talk about a city of the antiquity of Jerusalem. Mariam has already told you my topic that's listed above, and I think it's perfectly appropriate for me to be giving the second Edward Said London lecture on this topic. I think the dignity and Jerusalem were both subjects that Edward was himself deeply concerned about. and I can't think of something I would rather talk about on this occasion. The lengthy, very, very lengthy history of Jerusalem is distinguished by diverse episodes of benevolent tolerance and by many, many other episodes of inhumane intolerance. For several long periods, such as most of the 19th century, the Holy City was generally characterized by a spirit of coexistence. On too many other occasions, Jerusalem witnessed savage persecution and cruel massacres, two of the most horrific of these episodes of massacre and persecution took place after Jerusalem was captured following a prolonged siege. This happened once in the wake of a siege and sack of the city by the Persians in 614 of the Common Era, and it happened again in the wake of the siege and capture and sack of the city by the Crusaders in 1099. In both cases, many thousands of the city's residents were slaughtered by the victors. An area adjacent to the very ancient Mamilla Pool, west of the city walls of Jerusalem. It's still there. It's a rock-cut reservoir. An area adjacent to this pool was the scene of the first of these massacres, the massacre of 614. And it ended up being the burial site of the victims of this massacre. This place of carnage subsequently became the most reputed Muslim burial ground in Palestine, Ma'man Allah or Mamilla Cemetery, which is the topic of my talk. Now, I'm not an ancient historian. I'm a modern historian. But I mention this ancient history because I think it's relevant. It shows that the ongoing project to build what is described by its sponsor, the Simon Wiesenthal Center of Los Angeles, as a center for human dignity on part of the Mamilla Cemetery is not, in fact, the first indignity that this venerable site has witnessed. This project for a center for human dignity has gone ahead in spite of repeated protests by Palestinians, international figures, and Israelis. It's gone ahead in spite of two unsuccessful attempts to litigate against it in Israeli courts. The most recent effort to stop it was a petition that was presented in February of 2010 to five UN bodies. The petition was signed by members of an ad hoc group of individuals that was composed of 60 descendants of Jerusalem families whose ancestors were buried in the Mamilla Cemetery. In the interest of full disclosure, and Mariam has already mentioned this, I should say that I am myself one of those 60 people, and many, in fact, of my ancestors are buried in that cemetery. This group of 60 descendants of individuals who were buried in the cemetery were supported in their effort by the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. My presentation this evening aims to lay out some of the historical background relating to this site, this contested site. It aims to explain very briefly how this dispute over the site has evolved in the last few years, and it attempts to explore some of its implications. The Mamilla Cemetery was like all ancient cemeteries, or all cemeteries in the ancient world. In fact, until very recently, all cemeteries were located well outside the walls of cities for obvious sanitary reasons. The city, of course, has since expanded, as cities do, and Jerusalem now includes the cemetery, which is right in the middle of downtown Jerusalem today. The site seems at one stage to have been a Christian cemetery. There's evidence of a Byzantine chapel or some kind of Byzantine structure there, which grew up around one of the rock-hewn pools from which Jerusalem used to take its water in ancient times, the Mamilla Pool, and from which the cemetery takes its name. In the wake of the Islamic conquest of the city from the Byzantines, either in 637 or possibly 638, it's not clear, according to Islamic tradition, Mamilla is reputed to have become the burial place of several of the Prophet's companions, who died during or after the Muslim state's military campaigns in Syria and Palestine. That's tradition. We're not sure about that. We are sure of what followed. As Jerusalem became a focus of Muslim pilgrimage and learning in subsequent centuries, the Mamilla Cemetery became an important site of burial for pilgrims, for holy men, for scholars, for urban dignitaries, as well as for ordinary Jerusalemites. Among those historically attested to be buried there were numerous commanders and soldiers who died fighting in the army of Salah ad-Din, Saladin, which retook the city from the Crusaders in 1187. This group includes the ancestor of one of the 60 petitioners who submitted the petition to the United Nations in February of 2010. As in many other religions, burial sites in Islam are supposed to be places of eternal rest. According to the unanimous opinion of Muslim scholars, disinterment of the dead is strictly forbidden in Islam, and the sanctity of cemeteries is considered to be eternal. They're eternally sacred sites in Islam. 19th century engravings and early photographs show a variety of Islamic tombs and religious monuments on the site, many of which are actually still in existence in the eastern end of the cemetery. The limits of the cemetery were clearly and absolutely defined when it was enclosed with a wall by the Ottoman authorities in 1860. There are British aerial photographs taken in the middle of the 20th century which show that the wall was still in place, exactly where the Ottomans put it in 1860. Those limits were not encroached upon for a century. Through the entire rest of the Ottoman period, through the entire British mandate, and through and beyond the first decade of Israeli rule over Jerusalem. The cemetery was declared an antiquities site by the British Mandatory Government in 1944. Throughout this period, the cemetery continued to be in use and was under the control of the local Muslim religious authorities, as is attested by a mandatory government deed issued to the religious authorities, the Awqaf, for the entire plot of 33 acres in 1938. The cemetery was, as I said, in continual use until it was incorporated together with the rest of the western part of Jerusalem into Israel after the war of 1948. The indignities, to which I'm going to be referring for the rest of this evening, began soon afterwards. The authorities of the new Israeli state had initially pledged to maintain the sanctity and integrity of the Memilla Cemetery. Israel's Religious Affairs Ministry in 1948 proclaimed it to be, quote, one of the most prominent Muslim cemeteries, adding that, quote, Israel will always know to protect and respect this site. 16 years later, in 1964, the cemetery was formally designated by Israel as an antiquities site. This designation proved meaningless, however, as in the same year, in 1964, a parking lot was built in the northern quadrant, the northernmost piece of the cemetery. A section to the west of that, northwestern corner of it, was built upon thereafter. And finally, a little later in the 1960s, the western area of the cemetery was turned into what has been called since then Independence Park. Needless to say, these encroachments on the northern and western parts of the cemetery constituted desecrations and diminished the extent of the cemetery that was left. But none of them involved extensive excavations, and thus none of them involved the disturbance of graves in most cases, or at least it was limited. Nevertheless, human remains were turned up during the paving of the parking lot in the 1960s and during other subsequent operations in that period, sparking public protests. It's important to note that before 1966, these protests by Arab citizens of Israel, by Palestinians who lived inside Israel, were necessarily muted in consequence of the fact that the entire Arab population of Israel lived under military rule from 1948 till 1966. They couldn't move without permits. Those permits were only given on condition of good behavior. The General Security Services tightly monitored all political activity. And so, given those controls, protest was very, very difficult. To understand how and why even these levels of infringement were possible on such an ancient and important sacred site, it's necessary to explain the discriminatory treatment in Israeli law and in Israeli practice of Muslim waqf property. Waqf is a perpetual religious endowment. Of Muslim waqf property as distinguished from the property of Jewish and Christian religious endowments. From the time of the establishment of the State of Israel, all Muslim waqf property throughout the country, this includes mosques, this includes cemeteries, this includes holy sites, tombs of holy men, a vast amount of other property, which was established under the Ottomans and maintained during the mandate period as the property of the waqf authorities, all of this property, without exception, all over the country, came under the control of the custodian of absentee property, an institution of the Israeli state, instead of remaining under the control of the Muslim religious authorities, as is the case with the property of all other faiths in Israel, which control their awqaf, their religious endowments, and is the case, as is the case generally, with waqf property elsewhere in the world. Now, it's worth saying a couple of words about this institution, the custodian of absentee property, at this point. This unique institution of the Israeli government was specifically designed to despoil Palestinians, both those who were driven from their homes in 1948, those who fled, and others who remained behind in Israel and became Israeli citizens, or those who left subsequently. Anyone who became, under Israeli law passed in 1949, what is called an absentee in Israeli law. Despoiling them of their lands and other movable and immovable property. That's what the law was designed to do, and that's what the custodian's job was. It's worth noting in this context that in 1948, at the time of the what Israelis call the War of Independence, Jewish land ownership in Palestine amounted to less than 7% of the land area of the country. I think this explains, if you think about it for a second, the urgent need for an institution like the custodian of absentee property and for the law under which that institution operated. If the most of the mainly Arab-owned land of what was Arab Palestine before 1948, or predominantly Arab Palestine before 1948, were to be transformed into the property of the State of Israel. And that is exactly what happened. How otherwise would it have been possible to turn what before 1948 was a predominantly Arab country into what afterwards became a predominantly Jewish state? Most of the land in Israel today, most of the land in Israel today has been expropriated in this fashion, through this law, by this agency, the custodian for absentee property. From the grasping hands of the custodian, these properties have devolved over time into the control of the Israel Lands Authority or of other state or parastate bodies like the Jewish National Fund, or in a few cases into private hands. Once taken over in this fashion, many of the properties originally under the control of the Islamic Waqf authorities were put to secular uses, but many of them have been left abandoned or derelict. This has led to mosques and Muslim holy sites all over Israel, such as the mosque in Tiberias, which is an 18th century structure, being desecrated in a variety of ways over the years. It's happened to many, many other similar properties. Precisely these things happened to different parts of the Memina Cemetery, as I've already mentioned. But much worse was to come in 2002, when the northern section of the cemetery, which in 1964 had been paved over and turned into a parking lot, was granted to the Simon Wiesenthal Center for their project of building a center for human dignity. This project is meant, according to the website of Simon Wiesenthal Center, to encompass what amounts to about 10% of the total area of the original cemetery, an area of about 3.5 acres. It was approved by the Jerusalem municipality, to which control over the entire cemetery had devolved in 1992. Now, given the appropriation of religious holdings such as this cemetery by various agencies of the Israeli state, it goes without saying that such sites could not be protected, preserved, or restored by the appropriate religious authorities whose job this is. This is the case in spite of the fact that these religious authorities hold unassailable legal title to these properties. I mean, I have a copy of the 1938 title deed issued by the mandatory authorities to the Okaf, because this title is unrecognized by the legal system of the Israeli state, even though it's a mandatory legal title. Thus, before sections of the cemetery were earlier turned into a parking lot or a park or other profane purposes starting in the 1960s, they had been allowed to deteriorate significantly. And you can contrast aerial photographs taken in the 40s with aerial photographs that have been taken more recently to see how that deterioration took place. And this is, in fact, what is currently happening to the remaining small section, the remaining untouched area of the original cemetery at the eastern end of the plot, where numerous gravestones can still be seen. With the Muslim religious authorities forbidden from tending this remaining eastern section of the cemetery, it has become overgrown, gravestones have been knocked down by vandals, and it became known as a seedy, disreputable, and dangerous area at night. But at least there, and in most other parts of what was once a 33-acre cemetery, in spite of these desecrations, most of the dead are still allowed to rest in peace, even if they're resting under asphalt or with a park above them. This was not the case on the parcel that we are focused on, the area that was to be handed over to the Simon Wiesenthal Center. The saga of the specific indignities that were inflicted on this part of this sacred site by the process of the building of this Center for Human Dignity, which is currently underway, is beyond ironic, given the high-sounding title of the institution that is planned for being placed on top of part of the oldest cemetery in Jerusalem, Muslim cemetery in Jerusalem, in spite of the protests of people the descendants of people who were buried there. It was in the name of the building of this Center for Human Dignity, in the name of human dignity, that what we understand from the archaeologists were three or four layers of graves, ranging from the 11th century to the 1930s, were initially disturbed and have all since been removed. All the human remains underneath the site have now been removed. We know this not because you can look at the site has a huge wall, CCTV cameras, and ferocious guards around it. You cannot see it. But we know it, fortunately, because of the reports and testimony of the man who was the director for the Jerusalem District for the Israel Antiquities Authority and who served as the chief excavator during the mandatory archaeological survey, which took place at the site before building is allowed under Israeli law, which is mandatory law, which was Ottoman law. You can't dig anything. You can't build anything without having an archaeological investigation. That man is named Gideon Soleimani. Soleimani's partial investigations affected only about 400 of the many thousands of graves he estimated were on the site chosen for this Center for Human Dignity. Nevertheless, what he discovered during his excavation was what he described as, and I'm now quoting Soleimani, the cemetery of the residents of the vicinity, men, women, and children, very crowded, very orderly, which shows that the society was very organized with a great deal of mutual respect, unquote. Headstones which Soleimani and his co-workers unearthed in his rushed excavations, some going as far back as 1278, indicated that the cemetery also contained, in his words, quote, militarily, religiously, and politically elite Muslims, unquote. In light of these discoveries, and in light of the uproar that they caused in the Israeli press and among Israeli academics, Israel's Supreme Court temporarily halted all work on the site for over a year, while it considered a suit that was filed in 2006 to force abandonment of the entire project. The Simon Wiesenthal Center won its case in 2008 after 2 years that work was halted, and this was a judgment that the Israeli Supreme Court refused to reconsider in 2009 in response to a second suit brought before it. The second court case highlighted disturbing revelations in Soleimani's formal report to the Israel Antiquities Authority, revelations which had been ignored by the authority itself, in fact, had been distorted by the authority itself in its submissions to the court, and they were in turn ignored by the court. Now, we know from Soleimani's affidavits and from the Israeli press that the Simon Wiesenthal Center won its case essentially with the connivance of officials of the Israeli archaeological authorities by a process that Soleimani has stated in a sworn affidavit included the systematic falsification by his superiors in the Antiquities Authority of the reports he had submitted on his excavations. In these reports, Soleimani insisted that construction could not and should not proceed without a thorough investigation of the entire site devoted to this Center for Human Dignity. That did not take place. It never happened, and he estimated that he was only allowed to survey 10% of that 3.5-acre parcel, and notwithstanding his protests, notwithstanding these court cases, construction resumed in 2008. In the process, the thousands of unexhumed graves that he estimated were on the site as a result of his excavations were destroyed. The human remains they contained were removed. Nearly 3 years later, the number, the identity, and the location of those human remains are a closely held secret. We're told by statements from the Simon Wiesenthal Center that they have been removed, but we don't know where to. I think it's worth noting, or at least comparing, the silence certainly in the West that has enveloped the wholesale desecration of these many thousands of graves with the huge and understandable uproar that was made after 1967 and has been made ever since over the lamentable desecration by the Jordanian authorities of several score graves on the ancient Jewish cemetery in the Mount of Olives. We have a case here where thousands of graves were not just desecrated, were not just damaged, where gravestones were not just moved, where thousands of human remains were moved, and we don't know where they are. And very, very little, I think, has been said about this in the West. The systematic discrimination by the Israeli state, which I've already described as between Muslim religious properties and those of other faiths, applies to the remains of the dead as well. I'm quoting again Soleimani in his sworn affidavit. He said, I quote, "If the skeletons in question were Jewish, the story would have developed in a completely different direction. When the skeletons found," and he's talking about every excavation in Israel, "when the skeletons found are suspected to be Jewish, it is mandatory to notify the Ministry of Religions, and its representatives may discontinue the excavations." This happens all over Israel all the time. And that's my interpolation. And I'm continuing with Soleimani's affidavit statement. "It appears to me," he continued, "that the Muslim dead have nobody to protect them." Soleimani went on to call the assertions of the Israeli Archaeological Authority, on the basis of which the Supreme Court made its judgment in favor of Simon Wiesenthal's center, quote, "a factual and archaeological lie." Further, he said, the Israeli archaeologist, he further said that the Israel Antiquities Authority had carried out an archaeological crime, which deprived its work, in his words, of all moral and professional validity. Now, in view of these and many other facts that I don't have time to cite for you tonight, and in view of the arguments that were marshaled by the legal representatives of the 60 family members who were complainants in the 2010 petition and an addendum to that petition, which was submitted in June of 2010 as well, the UN bodies to which they were submitted have begun to respond positively, albeit in an agonizingly slow fashion, as is the way of the United Nations. The petitioners argued that the actions of agencies of the State of Israel, and in particular of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, violated customary international law in a number of specific ways. I'm not going to bore you with the international law bits, which I don't understand that well myself, I have to admit. But it sounded convincing to me. They asked these bodies to call for an immediate halt to all construction activity. They asked that the disinterred remains be located and reburied under the supervision of the relevant Muslim authorities in Jerusalem. And they asked that the entire site be preserved as a historical Muslim cemetery under appropriate religious auspices. And finally, that UNESCO ensure that the cemetery be protected as a cultural and religious heritage site of great value. That's a UNESCO term, cultural and religious heritage site of great value. The petition was directed to five United Nations officials, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, the Director General of UNESCO, two UN special rapporteurs, one on freedom of religion and the other on racism, and finally to the UN expert for cultural rights, as well as to the Swiss government in its capacity as the depository of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Under the UN Charter, as you may know, none of these bodies has the power to ensure that such things take place, nor indeed can the UN General Assembly. Under the UN Charter, only the Security Council can ensure that. It's worth noting that in 1980, after the Security Council deplored, I'm quoting a Security Council resolution now, "the persistence of Israel in changing the physical character, demographic composition, institutional structure, and the status of the Holy City of Jerusalem," after saying this, the Security Council, in a resolution numbered 476, affirmed, and now I'm quoting the resolution again, "that all legislative and administrative measures and actions taken by Israel, the occupying power, which purport to alter the character and status of the Holy City of Jerusalem, have no legal validity and constitute a flagrant violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention." That's the part of the text of UN Security Council Resolution 476 of 1980. It's of interest that the wording of this resolution does not refer to occupied Arab East Jerusalem. It does not refer to the old city of Jerusalem. It refers instead to the entire holy city of Jerusalem. This is a reflection of the wording of a whole series of United Nations resolutions passed by the General Assembly and the Security Council, going back to partition resolution of 1947, UN General Assembly Resolution 181, that called for the entire city of Jerusalem, east and west, as well as areas to the north and south of the city, going down to and including Bethlehem, to have a separate international status. Israel's admission to the United Nations in 1949 was conditional, among other things, on its commitment to abide by these provisions regarding Jerusalem. These and other resolutions have not been superseded, which is why Jerusalem is not recognized as Israel's capital or indeed as sovereign Israeli territory, any part of Jerusalem, by the vast majority of countries of the world. So these are the operative United Nations resolutions, Security Council and General Assembly resolutions. Given the decreased willingness of American administrations in the decades since 1980 to hold Israel accountable for any of its actions, an unwillingness that we most recently saw in the United States' veto of a Security Council resolution in December of last year, such a firm stand is unlikely to be taken by the Security Council in the near future. We'll have a test of that perhaps in September. Nevertheless, this 1980 Security Council resolution that I've quoted to you constitutes an important precedent regarding the entirety of the city of Jerusalem by the highest decision-making body of the United Nations. Moreover, the generally positive response thus far of the five UN bodies which were petitioned in 2010, even though it has been agonizingly slow, has encouraged the 60 petitioners who have continued their efforts. In little over a year, a public campaign has developed out of the original petition, including the writing of newspaper articles, TV and radio appearances, and so forth, explaining the details of this case. This, in turn, has helped to convince some of the UN bodies being petitioned, as well as others, of the importance of this case and of this approach as a legitimate means of recourse when there is no other recourse. The publicity around this issue was a key factor in the withdrawal from the project of Frank Gehry, the original architect chosen by the Simon Wiesenthal Center to design their Center for Human Dignity. He had designed the entire project. He withdrew as a result of essentially, as a result of this publicity. Similarly, other celebrities have declined to participate in events organized by the Simon Wiesenthal Center when its actions in the Mamilla case became known to them. Now, I went to Washington in the summer, actually in May of 2010, almost exactly a year ago, with the lawyer Michael Ratner, who happens to be the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which did the legal work on this petition. We were told that it was our duty to inform officials of the U.S. State Department about the petition and about the addendum so that they knew what was happening and could presumably do something. The first thing we were asked after we had given them copies of the various documents was whether this activity might lead to United Nations resolutions resulting in what they called, I'm quoting them, the delegitimization of Israel, and whether this might not constitute what they called, and again I'm quoting them, lawfare. Lawfare. Warfare, lawfare. Our response was that when Palestinians resort to violence to secure their rights or to resist discrimination and oppression, they're condemned for terrorism. When they or others use nonviolent, peaceful, and legal means to oppose a manifest violation of international law or some other action, they are perversely accused of lawfare. Immediately after we had this little exchange, the conversation took a more constructive turn and we were able to talk about the real world. Nevertheless, it must be asked, in what sense can the actions I've just described of the Simon Wiesenthal Center affecting the Mamilla Cemetery possibly be considered legitimate? Moreover, how could the legal petition of members of affected Jerusalem families about the desecration of the graves of their ancestors possibly do anything further to delegitimize these actions, which by any universal standards of justice or law are themselves illegitimate? In fact, if Israel is being delegitimized, the party primarily responsible for this delegitimization is the Israeli government itself through its own actions, such as the ones I have just described. I think it's a sign of the increasing degradation of American political discourse. It's a sign of the bankruptcy of United States diplomacy that senior American officials, someone who was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, was the one who used these terms, lawfare and delegitimization, to my face, that senior American officials use terms such as lawfare and delegitimization. If you follow the legal literature, you'll know that these are terms that were recently generated by extreme right-wing legal circles in the United States and in Israel to defend any and all actions of the Israeli state against approaches based in international law. It's unconscionable that such terms be used by American government officials to describe private legal efforts to mitigate profoundly unlawful and illegitimate acts such as the ones that I've described. I have to insist that these are not isolated or random acts. They're part of a pattern of systematically discriminatory policies that have been implemented against Palestinians since 1948 inside Israel, and that are still being implemented both inside Israel and in the occupied territories that were the territories occupied in 1967. These policies have, as I've said, have resulted in the expropriation of most of the territory of the state of Israel today, land that most of which in 1948 was privately owned by Arabs or was publicly held or was held as waqf, as pious endowments, like this property. The family petitioners in the Mamilla case have peacefully and legally opposed one such specific act, which any sane observer, I think, would agree is a manifest affront to human dignity. The effort by this group of families, ad hoc effort, constitutes one step along a path that is beginning to be explored by others. Such legal and civil society efforts may grow more widespread, may become more effective, now that the wave of peaceful protest, youth activism, and bottom-up civil society-based initiatives appears to be beginning to have an impact on Palestinian society after it swept through much of the rest of the Arab world. One example of these initiatives, bottom-up initiatives, was the organization of the May 15th Palestinian refugee marches on Nakba Day to the borders in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan to commemorate what happened in 1948. This represents an eruption onto the Palestinian scene of entirely new forces, largely independent of the discredited political factions, Hamas and Fatah, that have dominated Palestinian politics for so long. And it represents the return of the repressed, the return of issues like the issue of refugees, like the issue of Jerusalem, the kind of issue that I'm talking about, property rights, that have long been repressed and distorted in American and Israeli public discourse. Most recently, we were treated to the spectacle of the President of the United States saying that the issues of Jerusalem and refugees should be deferred yet again. They were deferred in the Madrid negotiations and all the negotiations that followed, so far for 20 years, so presumably President Obama wants to defer them for another 10 or 20 years. This is an example of the kind of repression that I'm talking about, and this is the kind of thing that bottom-up efforts, like the march on May 15th of this year, was meant to counter. I would add that a more democratic Arab world, should that be the outcome of the revolutionary events of the past 5.5 months, a more democratic Arab world is likely to be far more supportive of the Palestinians than were the undemocratic regimes that until recently completely dominated the Arab region. Most of these regimes, in fact, all of these regimes, lacked legitimacy with their own peoples. All of these regimes, with few exceptions, were so dependent on the United States as to be incapable of charting an independent foreign policy. Egypt did not have an independent foreign policy before the revolution, for example. Most of these countries do not really have independent foreign policies to this day. In the future, such an independent foreign policy, if it eventuates, would probably first be put forth by the most important Arab country, which is and has always been Egypt. And it is clear with the opening of the Rafah border, with the change of its policy towards Iran, with many other initiatives, that Egypt has already begun moving in this direction. This could produce innovative diplomacy to open up the kinds of repressed issues like Jerusalem and refugees that the United States and Israel have pushed off the table while changing facts on the ground, as has been happening in Jerusalem. It might also help end the logjam that has been created and perpetuated by 2 decades of fruitless American-sponsored negotiations, a so-called peace process, which has been all process and has moved us away from peace. During this period, the Israeli occupation has grown infinitely more entrenched than when Madrid took place in the fall of 1991. During this period, the crisis in Palestine and the oppression of the Palestinians have only gotten worse. There has been no peace process. This is a charade. This is Orwellian language. In any case, if such changes are to take place in the Arab world, they are in the future. they may or they may not take place, the course and the nature of the new Egyptian regime and of the revolutions and uprisings elsewhere in the Arab world are by no means settled yet, although things are undoubtedly changing, hopefully for the better, both in the Arab world and among the Palestinian people. In the meantime, however, I leave you with the thought that if these things change, maybe things will be better. But in the meantime, occupation, colonization, oppression, and dispossession continue unabated in Palestine. So does the indignity of the building of a so-called Center for Human Dignity in the midst of the oldest Muslim cemetery in the heart of Jerusalem, which is the scene of so many tragic indignities in the past. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm told I can take my own questions, and this being the British Museum, I'm sure there'll be no disruption. So, please, you might wait for a microphone so that everyone can hear you. There are microphones on both sides.
I understand that the U.S. government actually is going to fund most of the museum of tolerance, or now it's called human dignity, and Congress has passed funding. Isn't that an approach to attack this issue?
I didn't hear the first part of your question. I'm sorry.
I understand that the U.S. Congress is going to fund, or has passed already a bill funding most of this museum or the human dignity center, and if the funding is from the United States, I wonder if that is the approach to try to stop this the building of the center.
There has been an initiative to try and secure such funding, but it has not actually been secured yet. So the funding so far as we know, is all private. The Congress has not passed any such law. Given the 30-odd standing ovations for Prime Minister Netanyahu, I'm sure they would pass such a bill if it were put before them. But as far as we know, nothing has actually been brought before Congress. I can't see people. Yes, down here in front. Down here, please.
How do you feel about the fact that the Simon Wiesenthal Center called the return to 1967 borders a return to Auschwitz borders recently? Mm. I just think it's disgusting that they're being put in this situation where they can completely destroy Palestinian dignity and make comments like that. It just seems horrendously insulting.
No. I think that use of a term like that shows a couple of things. It's not the first time that term has been used. The Zionist Organization of America uses it regularly, and the Simon Wiesenthal Center's politics are very close to the most right-wing of American Jewish organizations, like the ZOA. I think it shows, firstly, I hate to say this, but a almost trifling use of the Holocaust. The borders that Israel had before 1967 were clearly perfectly defensible, since it overwhelmingly won a resounding victory in 1967 and were defended perfectly successfully for the 19 years before that. So they're not even indefensible borders, let alone genocidal borders which encourage a second Holocaust. So there's a complete lack of sense in this. But I think that it indicates a certain degree of loss of self-confidence on the part of some of the leading institutions that maintain some of the ideas that many Americans in particular hold about Palestine and Israel, entirely false ideas. I think they're a little bit rattled, frankly, by the fact that the younger generation in the United States, within the Jewish community and without, doesn't believe most of the nonsense that their parents drank in with their mother's milk or learned when they went to see the movie Exodus, which is the source of most myths that most Americans believe. Either they read the book or they watched the movie, and that's where a lot of their ideas actually come from. That and similar incredibly valuable sources. And it bespeaks a slight degree of panic when you immediately go to the nuclear option, which is to talk about the Holocaust. It's clear that you don't have the same grasp over public opinion that you used to have. And I think it has decreasing weight and strength and power and valence with audiences to have it used in this kind of fashion, to back up the discourse of a right-wing Israeli prime minister in this way by evoking the Holocaust with the term Auschwitz. I mean, I don't think it speaks very well to the Simon Wiesenthal Center, frankly. I mean, a center established in the name of someone who made his career hunting Nazis. Simon Wiesenthal, by the way, had nothing to do with the center. Rabbi Marvin Heyer, the dean of the center, took the name because he thought it would be a good name to take, and it served him very well. So the late Simon Wiesenthal actually had nothing to do with the center. The gentleman in the yellow tie on the right.
Rashid, good to see you back in London. This has also happened, hasn't it, in the vicinity of Tel Aviv? Isn't there another major Muslim cemetery that has been appropriated for some euphemistically idealistic operation by a Zionist organization? And isn't it essentially what's happened in 500 villages all over Palestine?
In most of those villages, yes, it's happened in a number of cemeteries. It happens mainly in big cities because the real estate's valuable. We're told that in Jerusalem there's a plan to build court buildings on part of the cemetery. And it's right in the middle of the city, and there's enormous pressure as a result from developers and from the state. In fact, what's happened in the villages is slightly different. They always preserve the mosques. They're usually desecrated, they're left abandoned, they're derelict, but the buildings usually are kept there. In a few cases, they're reused for all kinds of profane purposes, but mostly the mosques are kept. What's often not are the cemeteries. Those are plowed under, those are reused, and so on and so forth. So there are several hundred villages, village cemeteries, which have had pretty much exactly what's happened to Memidla happen to them. The only difference is this one happens to be in Jerusalem. It happens to be the largest in the Muslim cemetery in the country, and probably the oldest. And there are 60 descendants of people who were buried there who are making a fuss about it. The Jaffa residents whose ancestors are buried in Tel Aviv have not yet organized themselves, but hopefully, presumably, will. The gentleman next to him, since we're on the right.
Has Israeli treatment of Palestinian Christian holy sites been markedly different to the fate of the Waqf?
It has. Both Jewish and Christian religious sites had, under Ottoman and mandatory law, exactly the same status as did Muslim sites. Each was under the control of the communal institutions of the community. And in the case of both Christian and Jewish religious sites inside Israel after the establishment of the state, that status quo was maintained, as it actually was for religious law for all faiths inside Israel. In other words, personal status law is governed by the rabbinate, by the Muslim authorities, or by the church, whichever church one happens to belong to. There's no such thing as civil marriage. There's no such thing as civil divorce. All civil status is essentially Ottoman in Israel, as it is in Lebanon. But with property, there's a distinction, such that Christian and Jewish property is under the absolute and complete control of the religious authorities of the different faiths, Catholic or Jewish or Protestant or whatever, Orthodox. That's not the case with Muslim property. That property, without exception, was simply taken over and given to the custodian of absentee properties. That's why I talked about discrimination between, in terms of the treatment of property. That's not the case in terms of civil personal status, where each religion has its own control of marriage, birth, death, divorce, and so on, and inheritance, and so forth. It is the case, however, with property, all property. Down here in front, Gada. Pardon me?
Could you take this question first?
Can I? I suppose I can. You'll be second. Someone else has been given a microphone. I didn't see that hand, but yes, where is the person? I can't see you. Yes, sorry.
My name is Antoine Raffoul. I'm an architect. You raised the issue of Frank Gehry withdrawing from the design of the Memilla of the center. Mm-hmm. We have a campaign to raise the in ethics of architects working in historic Palestine, especially in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. We are campaigning to save Lifta at the moment, mm-hmm. as you've heard in The Guardian and other papers. The issue of Lifta has been raised now. I think it is very important, beyond the politics and beyond the maneuverings throughout the international community, that architects should be really aware that their ethics really should be the guiding force, and they should really stop from getting involved in any architecture or planning in the occupied territories and in historic Palestine. I'm just wondering if you've heard about Lifta and what local campaigns over there have taken place. We have now applied for the World Heritage Watch to list Lifta, mm-hmm. and I hope this will happen before the Israeli Zionists take it over.
I know about what is being planned for Lifta. There's a huge development plan for Lifta, which is one of the very few villages that was abandoned in 48, but then not destroyed. Most were bulldozed in the 2 or 3 years after 1948. Lifta, for some reason, was an exception. So these very fine stone buildings are still standing. And as you drive down from Jerusalem to the coast, they're on your right. You can see them. It's an extraordinarily beautiful village, empty. Maybe one or two houses are occupied. It's completely inexplicable why it was never destroyed in the first place, because villages all over the country were simply destroyed, bulldozed. And now, of course, development is creeping up. Again, it's in the hands of the custodian of absentee property, who probably has leased it. I've actually read to whom it's been granted for this development. I don't know what is being done to oppose it. I've read that there's now publicity about it. I don't know more than that. I will add that it is obviously the job of architects to do due diligence on the historic background of the sites that they're asked to build on. And if there are these kinds of issues, one would think that would be something that an architect should pay attention to. And if not, they deserve the exposure that they will suffer when they turn out to be doing the kind of thing that Gehry fortunately has withdrawn from doing. They found two Israeli architects who are willing to do this, apparently. Yes, Ben.
First of all, thank you very much for a very eloquent, informative, well-researched lecture, exactly what one would expect from you, Rashid. Now, my question refers to what can be done about this. Now, I know that you know, and many people in this room know, that the problem about Israel is that nobody stops it. Nobody can stop it. That's the problem, isn't it? I mean, there are so many, there's a long catalog of misdemeanors, illegal behavior, atrocities, all the rest of it, but they proceed because they are not stopped. Now, what I want to ask you is, I know you've been very active in this and you are to be commended, and your colleagues and everybody who's been working on this. Is there anything else that occurs to you that we can do? I feel sure there are many people in this room who feel, as I do, that perhaps are ready to become active, to do something. Mm-hmm. Do you have any suggestions?
I mean, insofar as Mamina is concerned,
yes.
I wish I did. I think that the thing that we probably haven't done as well as we should is to take advantage of the fact that these are issues that can best be raised probably in the United States and in Israel, because that's where the impunity comes from. If it weren't for the fact that this is cloaked in misinformation and deception and distortion within the United States and within especially the American political process and also in Israel, the impunity wouldn't continue. Now, that's a tall order to change that, obviously. But it's one of the things that we've been trying to do in the United States that this campaign has tried to do. So it's operating obviously on a legal level, but it's also operating on a public level, trying to just simply inform people about this. not so much because we are, or not only, I should say, because 60 individuals are concerned that their ancestors' remains are going to be disturbed, but because this is really quite an important site historically, and because of what it says about the whole conflict, about the disrespect, systematic discriminatory disrespect, the indignities that are being inflicted on people. And this is just a key to that. This is just a symbol of those things. So the campaign has had a little bit of success in that respect in the United States. But obviously, a huge amount needs to be done. And I think that it's easier to do it in this country and in Europe because the level of misinformation, the level of toxic lies, is just nowhere near as high as it is in the United States. Actually, much of what we've used and much of what we've based ourselves on is generated within Israel, by Israelis, within the Israeli press. I mean, we got onto Soleimani because he gave an absolutely astounding interview to the Israeli press in which he said, the people I'm working for are a bunch of liars. They're committing archaeological crimes. He said, much of what I'm quoting is not from his press interview. It's from an affidavit that he gave, a sworn affidavit he gave later on. But the Israeli press carried out a huge campaign against this, and many Israeli academics. I think there's been, frankly, a terrible failure to sufficiently work on Israeli public opinion. And that can easily be done. I mean, this is the kind of thing that Israelis, many Israelis, would be sensitive to if it were brought home in a proper and a sensible fashion. And I mean, you know, we are literally 60 individuals. There's no group behind this. We raised money ourselves from among, you know, those few members of these families that had a little bit of money, literally a few thousand dollars. The Center for Constitutional Rights, God bless them, did all that work pro bono. All the legal work, the entire drafting of a 60-page legal brief and a 40-page addendum was done by the Center for Constitutional Rights. We didn't pay those lawyers. Those people's time is worth hundreds of thousands of dollars if they were billing as the kind of extraordinarily competent lawyers that they are. So it was a shoestring effort, and it is a shoestring effort. But it's an example of the kind of thing that, frankly, if done by individuals and groups, by civil society, together with lawyers, young and smart and competent lawyers, I actually think could have an impact, but it has to be linked to working within the United States on public opinion. I mean, that's where the impunity comes from, that and Israel. The problem is really not here. We have other problems in the Arab world. We have problems in Palestine, in the incompetence of our leaderships, the undemocratic and illegitimate nature of governments. That's yet another problem if you want to resolve the Palestine issue. But where the real core of the problem is the United States and Israel. And that's where the work has to be done. It's the hardest place to work, obviously. But this is a tiny, itty-bitty little campaign. But when I said in my talk, this is an example of the kind of thing that can be done. This is the kind of thing that these Arab revolutions have grown out of. A tiny group here, a network there, a dozen people here, 150 people there, people who have experience and failed here and failed here and failed, and then they finally try it again and it works. That's what everybody in Cairo told me a month and a half ago. They did when they marched into Tahrir. And out of that has grown a revolution. And I'm not suggesting we're anywhere near that in terms of the Palestine issue, but that's what created this march on May 15th, which has just brought back the issue of the refugees in a way that people like you and me and 20 other people who've written on this have never been able to do, frankly. I mean, I don't have any advice. All I know is that we took this issue because we really were offended. I mean, we really were offended. These are our ancestors that these people are building a center for human dignity on top of. It just was, and it was the Israeli press that actually clued us into it, to be very frank. The young woman in the middle in the back, red hair. It'll take about 20 minutes for the microphone to get to you. Just be patient.
Hello, thank you for your talk. I just wanted you to say a little bit more, actually, about the legality of just taking people's remains and not saying where those remains were to the families. How is this justified? Could you say a little bit more about that, please?
Well, I mean, you're talking about remains that go back to the 11th or 12th century. So we don't know whose families they belong to. And according to Soleimani's reports, my daughter's an archaeologist, so I sat down with her and I read this stuff. She said they forced them, Soleimani says they were forced to work so fast that they couldn't do proper archaeological work, some of which might have revealed who some of these remains were, would have revealed the names of some of the individuals whose remains were being unearthed. That would have required a careful archaeological process, which simply didn't take place. They were rushed by the political imperatives that were involved in this, according to the archaeologist himself. We don't know whose remains they were, and there's probably now that they've, whatever they've done with them, there's probably no way of knowing it. For the more recent ones, there would be, actually. For the remains that some of them date, according to him, to the 1930s and the 19th century. So some of those probably would have been easily identifiable. In any case, according to the lawyers who did the work, this is a violation of a whole slew of international conventions. And that's why the petition was directed to five different UN bodies. I mean, cultural rights. Their whole series of international laws, which apparently were violated by doing this sort of thing, as well probably as Israeli law. But there we are. The Israeli Supreme Court has decided otherwise, so that's not that's not that part of it's no longer debatable. Yes, Jacqueline.
Well, first of all, thank you for that wonderful talk. It's so apposite that you give it here, and it's so apposite in relationship to Edward Said's legacy. So I just wanted to say that. And then two questions, one short and one perhaps a little bit longer. One is, how are they justifying it? The Simon Wiesenthal Center, who isn't Simon Wiesenthal. I mean, you know how the custodian of absentee property justify what they're doing.
Right.
But this is meant to be a center for dignity.
Right.
So what do they say when they're faced with these objections? Question number one. Second question follows from Gada Kami's question about what is to be done.
Mm-hmm.
You are speaking here. Netanyahu was speaking there very recently. A number of us are utterly dismayed by what is happening in America when you say that it is America that where things need to move by
right.
What Obama is not doing. Some of us know, how shall I put this as subtly as possible, that you knew Obama. We want to know from you what the hell is going on.
Mm. That's the big question, presumably.
Yeah, that was a big question.
Well, let me answer the small question first. They simply ignore most of these objections. They say Marvin Heyer is a politician. He's a rabbi, but he's a politician. I mean, he's a man who romanced Arnold Schwarzenegger and got him to come to the opening ceremony when he was governor, before he became known for his latest escapade. Some of you followed in the British press, perhaps, while he was governor of California. He's gotten almost every politician in California and in many other politicians in the United States lined up behind what he does. So, you know, he believes in brute force and he believes in, you know, playing a political game. And he's basically said, you lost in the courts and that's it. It's all over. Tough luck. The Israeli Supreme Court has decided your objections have no standing and therefore end of discussion. Tough luck, the thing's going to be built. That's basically what he says. Their submissions are disingenuous. Their submissions to the Israeli courts, which I looked at, we looked at length, even though we weren't party to the litigation. The litigation was germane to what we and our lawyers were doing. It's just a tissue of fabrications and distortions and so on and so forth. They say, among other things, nobody objected to the initial building of the parking lot, therefore, why should anybody object to our taking that same piece of property and digging further down? Well, firstly, because nobody could object in 1964 because they would have been not allowed to leave their villages by the Shabak, the General Security Service, which controlled every Palestinian inside Israel. You couldn't do anything without, you couldn't move, literally, could not move from your village without the permission of the officer who controlled your village. End of discussion. So how could you protest? There were no Palestinians left in West Jerusalem. 30,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed from West Jerusalem. We think of Jewish West Jerusalem and Arab Israel. No, both sides of the city had Jewish and Arab populations before 1948. So there was nobody left in West Jerusalem to protest. And these things took place before 1967. So there you are. I mean, one could go through the things that they said. It's basically a litany of lies and distortions and disinformation. put together by very good lawyers, very expensive, very good, very expensive lawyers. That's what some of them unfortunately do, good, expensive lawyers. Your bigger question. I would encourage you not to look at the big picture. I would encourage you to avoid, because it's painful to the eyes, looking at the U.S. Congress. The U.S. Congress is a place where reality doesn't often intrude, where Palestine and Israel are discussed. They live in a parallel reality. They live in a universe different from ours. I said some once, we are the reality-based community, they are another community entirely, Congress. And there are historic reasons for that, which I could talk about if you're interested. And to some extent, to a decreasing extent, that's been true of the American media. It's still, to a large extent, true of television. It's true to many other parts of the mainstream media, but it's decreasingly true of the media that more and more people are watching, which is not the mainstream media, or reading, or whatever. Online, the 900-to-1 advantage that the Israeli narrative has against other narratives is reduced to nil, almost. There's almost no advantage online. So if I were to be talking to an audience of my students, most of them would know a much more balanced set of things about of 20-year-olds and 22-year-olds and 24-year-olds in the United States than anybody 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 or, God knows, 50 or 60 years older than they. So as you go down in age, you go up in terms of real knowledge in the United States. And it's extraordinary how fast that has changed. I mean, on university campuses, you actually don't want to be an advocate of a lot of Israeli positions. They're indefensible to anybody with any moral sense. But they're actually indefensible on the university campus, including university campuses, which include large numbers of people, students who are pro-Israel. Because even those students are nauseated by some of those arguments. They're just untenable today in certain important universities, not just Columbia, and not just Berkeley, and not just the most elite universities. And this is a sea change. I mean, when I was an undergraduate back in the 60s, that wasn't the way things were. I mean, you couldn't put forth any kinds of theses that contradicted the what I call the Exodus narrative. I don't mean the Bible. I mean the book movie. Without facing overwhelming controversy. Today, you can't put forward the kinds of things that are said in that book and that most people my age and above in the United States believe on a university campus without people really arguing with you, including people who are pro-Israel. So when you say the United States, there's the United States if you mean the Congress, that's one thing, or if you mean CNN. But if you talk about what kids actually, none of them watch CNN. They watch Jon Stewart and The Daily Show. And they take the piss out of Netanyahu and Obama for his craven capitulation to Netanyahu almost every time they cover the issue. And that's what the kids believe, that this is a farce, and the politicians are liars, and the mainstream media peddles rubbish. That's what they believe. And so they don't take seriously the sources that most of their elders have gotten their information from. Things are changing very, very rapidly. I mean, faster than I believed possible a few years ago when this change began. So that's the good news. And I mean, it's not only my impression. I mean, there are now a whole series of studies. The piece that was written in the New York Review of Books by Peter Beinart about 8 months ago, a wonderful piece in Haaretz magazine. I forget the author, actually even better than the Beinart piece, where they go into what is happening in synagogues and the generational difference and the difference between liberals and more conservatives, individuals and older and younger people. It's absolutely astounding what's happening. And that's mirrored throughout American society. I mean, what's happening in the Jewish community is happening in American society. So you have much more conservative, older people that believe everything they were ever told, every lie, every fabrication, every distortion, desert blooming, you name it, that their leaders told them to flee. Arabs are going to destroy Israel in 67. Every myth ever created, every myth ever spun, the older people, the more conservative people believe. So if you go to the South, if you go to areas where Christian fundamentalism is strong, you'll see very large proportions of people who still believe that. You go to younger, more liberal populations, and it's a different world, actually. So that's actually the good news about the United States. The point is that has to be capitalized upon. Somebody has to do something about that. And it's beginning, but it'll take some time. Yes, sir, the gentleman here in the glasses. Wait for the microphone. I know you're eager. I can tell, but wait for the microphone. So I can hear you.
Thank you once again for your presentation. When you said to the lady who asked the last question, don't look at the good picture, or don't worry about the big picture, are you saying that even if Obama wins a second term, nothing good is going to come out of him?
I didn't say that. I didn't say that at all. No, I didn't even answer Jacqueline's question about Obama. Purposely. But now you've put me on the spot. I'm gonna take my ritual dodge. I'm a historian, and the job description of a historian does not include predicting the future. So I don't know what will happen if he's elected. I don't know if he will be elected, and if he's elected, I don't know what will happen. I don't think there's a whole lot of historical evidence for the second term of an American president being all that different on this issue than the first term. I mean, you can look at the Clinton presidency, you can look at the George W. Bush presidency, you can look at the Eisenhower presidency. I could go on and on, bore you to tears with American presidential names. And I don't think you'll see an enormous difference between the first and the second term. That's the first thing. The second thing I would say is that this is clearly a man who knows more about the world than almost any American president, except maybe Dwight D. Eisenhower, who lived many years in this country and fought a big war and commanded hundreds of millions, actually, of soldiers, and therefore knew a little bit about the world, a lot, actually. For an American, an enormous amount about the world. But with that one exception, most American presidents have not known a huge amount of the world. Maybe John F. Kennedy, because his dad was ambassador here, he served in the South Pacific. There are a couple who actually had actually been outside the borders of the United States on something besides, you know, conquering parts of Mexico or whatever, which a couple of American presidents did. And so this is a president who's actually lived in a foreign country, in a certain sense, to some extent, as a foreigner, with an Indonesian stepfather, going to Indonesian schools. That's a very unusual experience. He has East African relatives, half brothers and half sisters, and so on and so forth. So he is an individual who actually knows a great deal more about the world than a lot of people, not just Americans. However, he's not just, you know, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Chicago, which he was when I knew him. He's the president of the United States, and he operates within the context of structures that are not just constraining, but determinant in terms of what he does and doesn't do and what he can and can't do. And it's not just electoral politics. He has all kinds of advisors on the wrong side of his shoulder. I mean, he has one group that tells him, Mr. President, the Arab world is undergoing a world historical upheaval. We must do something completely different in Palestine, Israel, or we're going to be in real trouble in this important strategic region of the world. You cannot give in to Netanyahu, and others on that same side who tell him, Mr. President, what Netanyahu and the Republicans in Congress are doing is unconstitutional. They are trying to seize executive prerogatives that under the Constitution belong to the president. You have to resist. On the other side, there are people who are telling him completely different things. And it's not just people telling him you need to win Florida or you need to win state Y or Z or A or B or C in 2012. There are people who are telling him the same, selling him the same snake oil that these advisors have sold the last five presidents. Dennis Ross and his ilk are alive and well in the White House and in the State Department. And those people are selling the president the same rubbish. It was in his speech, paragraph after paragraph of flannel. Deferring Jerusalem and refugees? That's the conflict. How do you defer the conflict? The conflict is not borders. The conflict is refugees and Jerusalem. Borders is an afterthought. Borders, security, important, but secondary. But that has been peddled since Ronald Reagan by the same lot of professional, I mean, people who've made their careers out of steering the United States in entirely the wrong direction on this issue. The government and the think tanks are packed with them, and there's nobody else. There's nobody to counter them. So it's not like he has anybody telling him anything different. So it's not just the political; it's the policy side of it. And he has whole institutions headed by people at the top that tell him that. And we're talking about institutions the size of small states. I mean, intelligence community in the United States has a budget that's probably as big as, I don't know, the Netherlands. The defense budget? The defense establishment? That's probably a budget bigger than the United Kingdom. I don't know. I don't know the numbers. But it's humongous, and it's a lot of people, and there's a lot of expertise, and at the top of it Those people tell him some things that are a little bit different. But the point is, I am not one of those who thinks that this is going to change quickly. I am not one of those who thinks that this is going to change without enormous, assiduous effort. I'm not one of those who thinks that the political reality is going to change. The political reality is that the institutions of the American Jewish community look solid. They don't represent the base, but they look solid. Most American politicians are terrified of those institutions represented by AIPAC. And that's the political reality that a president operates in. A president can't operate independent of those things. No president, whatever he or she, one day there'll be a she, thinks. So I don't think it matters who Barack Hussein Obama is in terms of those kinds of constraints, frankly. And I think that's been proven so far, again and again and again and again. It doesn't mean he won't necessarily do things. I think that the situation in the Arab world is going to force them to do things. And it's going to force Netanyahu and the Israelis to do things that might change these givens. More has changed in the last 5.5 months than it's changed in the last 15.5 years, as far as I can tell, on this issue alone, and that's just one issue. And I would guess, I don't know, I have no idea what's going to happen, but I would guess that would be a source of faster change than the grassroots stuff that I'm talking about that's percolating in the United States and that will lead to change, but that's change over a decade or more, maybe. Whereas these are things that the United States is going to have to deal with very, very quickly. Read what's coming out of the Arab world in response to Obama, and people are saying, this is the most irrelevant, foolish speech we've ever heard. Instead of the kind of veneration of every word coming from Washington, which the Arab elites are so prone to, you've had a yawning and a saying, you're making yourselves irrelevant. You know, nobody was going to take you seriously as a mediator, as the sole sponsor of a peace process. There is no peace process, and we don't think you're really relevant any longer. We'll see, because it depends on what happens in the Arab world. There are still elites fighting for survival in the Arab world, which are and have always been completely dependent on the United States. They will continue to buy the same snake oil from Washington. But those elites are in more precarious situation than they've been for 50 years or 40 years. And we'll see. A lot more, I think, will depend on that than what happens in Washington, frankly. I'm not optimistic at all about Washington. It's not a good place. Up in the back. And then in the front. in the last row there, please.
How long do you think it will be before your young students, as they climb the corporate ladder of American companies, go back to their parents' views?
Well, I actually think that my young students, we have a bit of a sample from which to judge, because you can this is a process that started over a decade ago, and the ones who left the university and left professional schools and went into business or went into NGOs or went into whatever they went into, still seem to have the views that they developed as 20-odd-year-olds. So it hasn't yet, this process has not yet been reversed. And I think that this is partly a function of information. Younger people have access to sources of information that older people like myself, and I can't see you, so I don't know how old you are, but many of us in this room are only dimly aware of, let alone able to exploit. And they have what I call a bullshit meter. I mean, they know that most of what's in the mainstream media is really complete rubbish. They know it, and they don't take it as seriously as their elders do. Now, they may become, you know, sclerotic and old and conservative as they get older. That probably will happen to some of them. But I think this is an issue where there's been a level of deception and a level of concealment of some basic moral realities that once you tear the curtain back, and once you see, you know, what's going on behind that curtain, it's very, very hard to veil your eyes again and pretend that, you know, everything is fine and these lies can be revived. I don't think that's possible. I think that the whole discourse moves to a different place. It doesn't mean the problem is solved, but it means that we're dealing with I think that, frankly, the major motivator of this has been Israel's actions. So when I said, what's causing the delegitimation of Israel is Israel, Israel's own actions. I would argue this goes right back to the 82 war. I would argue it goes back to the first Intifada, but you can see it in a much more recent time span, starting with the 2006 attack on Lebanon, followed by the 2008-2009 attack on Gaza, followed by the flotilla. The way that had an impact on young people in the United States was extraordinary to my perception. I mean, I do recall some of these earlier episodes, and they didn't have anything like the same impact. I don't know if that's permanent. You may be right. They may all become, you know, conservative like their parents, but I don't think so on this issue. There's so much deception involved. There's just so much. I have a sense that things have changed to some extent permanently. And the panic that some of the institutions that maintain this, this set of fictions are showing indicates that they feel the same thing. They've said, we're losing the battle. They said in 2003, we have to take back the campus. What does it mean when pro-Israel groups say in 2003, we have to take back the campus? They had lost the campus in their estimation? This is the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, an article in 2003. And that is one of a whole series of articles that have been written with greater and greater urgency, a greater and greater degree of panic. We have stuff going on campuses these days where counteractivity would just overwhelm it 20 or 10 years ago. Sometimes there's not even counteractivity when there's pro-Palestine activity by students. And I'm astonished. So I don't know. They may change. They may all become, you know, conservative bankers and send their money to, you know, build forests on the ruins of Palestinian villagers like their parents did. But I'm not so sure about that. Don't know. Down here in front, please.
Thank you very much for your talk. The return of the repressed that you mentioned, I think, is absolutely accurate and incredibly poignant. We haven't been in Europe much this evening. But if you take the return of the repressed back to Europe and the loss of Jewish cemeteries throughout Europe from medieval times to more modern times, the European Jew who goes in search of his heritage cannot find it mainly because it's just not in the villages. Now that seems to be a profound moral imperative that somehow escapes Israel. It's detached from this European Jewish heritage of loss. And in Europe, there was no recourse to go to the courts. That was useless. In Israel, it seems that you can go to the courts as if that's the defining factor. And yet, I would have thought for Jews all around the world, this human dignity is a profoundly Jewish affair as well that should be more mobilized.
Yes. In fact, the original opposition did not come from descendants of people whose ancestors were in the cemetery. It came from Israelis. It came from Israelis who were talking about exactly the same issues you're talking about. How can people be outraged about what happened to the Jewish cemetery in the Mount of Olives before 67, or outraged about what happens to cemeteries in Poland, and not speak out about this? So, I mean, that was the moral motor of much of the original activity around this. There were also Muslims who got involved, but actually they were not, for the most part, descendants of people who were buried there. Strangely enough, there were three groups. There were, I suppose you'd call them liberal Israelis. There were a lot of Orthodox Israelis who are just against any desecration of any cemetery anywhere ever, partly because they feel there might be Jewish graves there, but partly because they don't like the principle, because they want to make sure that Jewish graves remain undisturbed. So don't touch anybody else's graves. And then finally, conservative Muslims. Those were the people who were the most involved in the initial set of efforts long before the 60 people I'm talking about became involved about 2 or 3 years ago. I think that if we have had a failing, it's in not doing, this our group, it's in not doing more to go back and reconnect with those first two groups. The Orthodox, I mean, we've talked to some people in New York in the Orthodox community, and some of them have the same concerns that the Orthodox in Israel have, Orthodox Jews. But the liberal academics and the others, I don't think we've done as good a job as we could have. And those kinds of moral issues that you're raising are crucial. And, you know, things always come back in Jerusalem. The repressed always returns in Jerusalem. I mean, stuff gets dug up and you suddenly learn about things. So I have some confidence that this will. And the same is true of the refugee issue. I mean, people thought it was buried. People thought that Palestinians had forgotten. And what happened in the camps in Lebanon was, I was in Lebanon when these people went down to the border. Every camp in Lebanon sent thousands of people. And these are people who had never seen Palestine, from close up or from far away. And they went to the border, and the kids were just enraptured. And they were all young people. The people who were shot were, the 10 people killed were young men, mainly, and children. And the 100 or 80 or whatever who were wounded were mainly kids, young people, who have no personal physical connection with the villages they came, their grandparents probably, or great-grandparents, whoever, came from. And it's quite astonishing. And this happened on five different, in Jordan it was suppressed. I mean, you didn't hear about it, but it actually also happened in Jordan. The Jordanian authorities stopped them. It happened in Egypt, though they ended up going to the Israeli embassy because they couldn't get all the way across to Rafah. And then it happened in Gaza, and it happened in the West Bank, and it happened in Syria. We heard about Syria and Lebanon. It actually happened in five places, and it was coordinated by internet, by 20-year-olds or 24-year-olds or whatever. And the repressed came back. Pow, just like that. So I think that these kinds of moral approach, political types poo-poo it. But I actually think it's very powerful if it's properly used. I mean, you can't preach and you can't moralize, but these are ultimately moral issues. And I think that that approach is very important. Yes, the person over here. The young man over here, or woman, I can't tell. Woman, sorry, I apologize. I can't tell, you're sitting behind someone. Anyway, you'll be next. Last question? I'm told this is the last question, so you're gonna get the last, you get it, it's for him. Give this man a microphone, please.
One more.
I'm being told by my the people who run this that this is the last question.
I'd like to, sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I'd just like to say, you know, as a student in England, I haven't really been able to sample the propaganda of America, but I was quite interested in the official stance of CNN and everything, because students in my school who have access to the internet, most of them I've met are very staunch Zionists.
Really?
And, I asked them why, and they say because we're stronger than they are, which seems to be the general agreement. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if that carries on in American media, the idea that we're stronger than them and therefore we deserve the land, because that is the argument I've had put to me, which is a ridiculous argument.
I've heard that argument.
Yeah,
but
is that general?
I've heard it, you know, back in the day. I don't think one hears it in the United States quite as much. There are other arguments that are given. In the United States, the people who are running this are spinmeisters. They're PR people.
Yeah.
They're using Fred Luntz, who's the best pollster in the United States. He worked for George W. Bush. And if you can turn a sow's ear into a silk purse like he did, then you can do anything. He's a genius, in public relations. And that's what, we've seen 100-page downloads of the manuals for what student groups should say. They don't use those kinds of arguments in the United States. They use much more sophisticated, indirect arguments. My impression, strangely enough, though, is it's not working so well.
Well, yeah, that's just
maybe in England it's different. I don't know.
I mean, I've just been, told, well, it's not our fault the terrorists hide under the kids' beds, which I didn't think was a very good point to make. Didn't really back it up with an argument. But so I was just wondering. The students don't seem to be very liberal from where I come from.
Well, it's a different world.
Hey, man.
You're the old world. We're the new world. What can I say? Thank you very much.